Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by Auto-Tune. Hey, hey. And now, here are Alex and James.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex. Next to me is James.
Hey.
Why do you always say hello like that? Like, you just, does it have to be the creepiest intro to a podcast? Like, is that an award we're gunning for?
I don't know. I'm not used to it yet.
Maybe this after. Is episode 35, I think. So, yeah. Okay. Well, now that the apparently obligatory creepiness is out of the way, we are going to be talking about the films of Darren Aronofsky today.
Well, you know what? I didn't do it intentionally, but this is probably the most appropriate podcast for a creepy hello. Because there's a lot of creepiness in his filmography.
Yeah, and in his mustache.
That too. How recent is that?
It's a fairly new thing.
Like two years, maybe.
I think it was I'm going to Venice with the wrestler. I'm going to have this mustache.
Okay.
Because I know he grows a beard at the beginning of production of every movie and doesn't shave it till the production's over.
Okay.
Which I think is cool, and I'm sure he's not the only director to do it, but I like when directors do stuff like that. But yeah, the mustache is just. Come on, man.
Look it up if you guys have never seen it.
We'll post a picture. I'm sure we will. I think the mustache is, I'm an auteur, look at my auteur mustache type of thing.
My auteur stache. Yeah. As you said, he's an auteur. We're doing another one of our second, I guess, our auteur cast.
Yes. Yeah, the last one you might remember was on Michael Mann, which I think aired...
Over the span of four months.
It was two parts. I think part one was in March, part two was in late April. But yeah, no, it was fun times, and I'm excited to do this one.
Yeah, because how much do you like Darren Aronofsky?
More than I thought I did. I used to think that he's the type of person that takes himself extremely seriously, and I kind of felt that way until about a week ago. I do not... feel that way entirely.
Okay.
Anymore. I still think he takes himself seriously, but I don't think he takes himself as seriously as people like us take him.
Yeah.
Which is very comforting.
I'd say he takes his work seriously, but not himself to be kind of a messiah of filmmaking.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're talking about five of his movies today.
Yes, all five of his films.
Well, what's the deal story with Below?
I don't know.
Okay.
It doesn't exist.
Anyway.
It doesn't exist here at the MacGuffin Men.
His films that do exist include Pi, Requiem for a Dream, The Fountain, The Wrestler, and Black Swan.
That's correct.
In chronological order.
Yeah. Good work.
Thanks. I had it written down, but I didn't even read it. Wow. I remembered it myself.
That's impressive.
So let's, you want to start with Pi?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, well, it's credited on IMDb as 1998, but at the end credits of the movie, it says copyright 1997. So, I mean... we'll say 98 because I trust IMDb more than I trust a specific movie that I just saw with my eyes. I like it. It's sort of about, I forget the main character's name, but he's a mathematician, apparently brilliant type of mathematician who is kind of obsessed with trying to figure out the universe through math. Like he does these sort of like personal rules where like all of these things exist. Like, and it's a really complicated movie. Like, the first time I saw it, I had no idea what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
And, I mean, synopsizing it is not going to sound anything but awkward. But he's just sort of trying to use math to figure out the stock exchange and then also figure out kind of the meaning of life type of thing, essentially, is what he's trying to do. He says there are patterns everywhere in life, so there has to be a pattern that will tell you things about life, you know? And yeah, it's sort of just about obsession and being confused about what life is about, I suppose.
Max, right?
Yeah, Max is his name.
Max.
Yeah,
played by
Sean Guillette or something like that.
Yeah, played by not John Turturro.
Do you think he looks like John Turturro? Really?
I don't know if he looks like him or if he acts like him, but something I don't know. It's like, if this was the third movie Darren Aronofsky made, I feel like it would just be John Turturro instead of that dude.
Fair enough. That's just an odd theory.
But. Yeah, absolutely. But he's a number theorist, as you said. He tries to find the patterns in, you know, geometry and nature and the order of the constellations. There's kind of an inherent numerical logic in obviously there's money to be made if you could figure out what's going to happen with the stock market. So as he's trying to, you know, figure that out, he's using a computer and a bunch of number theories that him and his former teacher, mentor taught him.
Yeah. Yeah. Played by Mark Margolis, who we will see in every Darren Aronofsky movie.
Is it all of them?
Yeah.
Okay. I know it was most of them. I didn't
he's
know,
barely so. In Black Swan, but he's allegedly there.
Okay. And yeah, I mean, what really drives the plot is him trying to figure this out, but also at the same time, there's a company, a financial company that is aware of kind of what a brilliant numbers guy Max is, and is trying to get him to explain to them how, you know, how his system of trying to predict the stock market works in order to make money off him, right?
Yeah. You're doing a much better job at this than I was. So okay. Thank you for stepping in.
So it's a black and white movie. It yes. looks very much like someone's first movie. And I don't mean that in a terrible way. But it, I mean, just compared to the other ones, just being black and white, kind of limited sets, not a lot of big scenes, right?
Yeah. Well, I would say it looks like someone's first film in that it's black and white and like 16 millimeter.
Yeah.
Stylistically, it is very advanced for the director's first movie.
Yeah, it's his first feature. I mean, he went to Harvard for film. He mm-hmm. went to the American Film Institution to study like live action and animation. So, yeah, it's very much his first kind of big movie, but this isn't like his first time behind a camera.
Yeah, no, I mean for feature film debuts rarely are, you know.
Yeah.
But but no, I think stylistically it's very advanced. There's a lot of what's called snorkam shots in this movie, which is
that's the one where they like attach it to the front of the actor actress, and then you walk around and it gets like just basically shoots your face and everything behind you.
Exactly, okay. And it's a really cool effect. It's used in a lot of music videos. The one that I remember is the Smashing Pumpkins 1979 or whatever 1970 song they made.
It's 1979.
Yeah, okay. That's a good song. They snorkel a lot in the video. But it's an interesting stylistic thing. And it's surprising that it works in feature film as well as it does. But I think it does.
Yeah, it's not so much in Pi. Although he is certainly doing pills. He's got a lot of... He's experimenting with medications throughout the movie to deal with these headaches that he has, right? But as you said, it's done in a lot of music videos. You see it in music videos and movies, usually when someone's drinking or on drugs.
Yeah,
because it's kind of like you still understand everything. It's still very clear, but it's a kind of an unusual thing because they're always dead center and everything's kind of revolving around them. And it is a cool effect when done properly. And yeah, I was surprised that it does work as well as it does.
Yeah. And I mean, probably most recently popularly used in Get Him to the Greek when Jonah Hill smokes the Jeffrey, I think it was called. Or
I forget what it's called, but
Yeah. It's a good effect. Anyways, but yeah, no, the movie's pretty, very pretty for like a $60,000 movie.
Yeah.
As far as, there's a lot of good symmetry in the shots, particularly in anything that's not handheld on the subway. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good like subway platform shots where it's just like the camera seems almost right in the middle. It might not quite be in the middle because I know they didn't have any permits for shooting the movie, so they had to be pretty quick.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, it's a good looking movie, and I mean, even for black and white, it looks good.
Yeah, I mean, $60,000 it is certainly a cheap movie, but it doesn't look haphazard or thrown together. I mean, you can tell he knows what to do with it. I guess made for $60 million, he sold
$60,000.
Sorry, much different.
Made for 60. He has never made a movie for $60 million.
So made for $60,000, then he sold the rights for $1 million, and the movie made $3 million, which is pretty good return on investment.
Yeah, absolutely.
$60,000 movie.
I know a lot of the financing for the movie came in $100 donations, and once they got the million, they paid back in like $150.
Yeah, just from like families and friends, local investors and stuff. So that's really cool.
Yeah, no, and it's a good movie. And I sort of when I first saw it, it was probably 2004, something around there. I thought it was cool to look at and watch, but I really couldn't follow it. And now I can easily follow it. And I think it is an interesting movie because I like the idea of somebody who's so obsessed with figuring out life that they can't enjoy life. Yes. Because he can't. Like, he's just such a depressing person, Max is, and he hates everything. All he can focus on is math, and it's just a bummer.
And he deals with a couple people. I mean, he deals with his landlord, but it's not very friendly. His mentor, what's his name again?
Mark Margolis. I don't remember his name in the movie.
Sal? Something like that.
Saul.
I mean, they talk and they get along, but they don't laugh. They don't joke. It's not pleasant. I mean, they're both kind of just obsessed with numbers.
Yeah,
they're
exactly.
Both good with numbers. And
playing a mathy game.
called Go, which looks like Othello, but isn't. Anyway. He doesn't have a lot of pleasant communication with people. When people in the street do approach him, he's instantly paranoid of them, and you really don't see him get along well with anybody for the movie.
Right.
And there's that, forget his name, the guy with like the beard and the hat.
Oh, yeah.
I forget his name.
Yeah.
But when he kind of just introduces himself to Max for the first time, Max really has no desire to speak with him until he starts talking about numbers and that he's also involved in numbers. And that's like, that seems to be the only way to talk to Max at all is to start talking numbers to him. He has no social anything. Even that little girl that lives in his building, Jenna, who goes up and does the calculator thing. Like,
yeah.
It's the only time you see him communicate with people is in the context of numbers.
Yeah. His next door neighbor who brings him samosas or something. I don't think there's math in all of their conversations, but.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. But she is bringing gifts. So.
Yeah.
It's good that somebody makes sure this guy eats.
Yeah, other than the pills that we see him eat constantly, which is going to be another recurring theme in the career of Darren Aronofsky.
Yeah. I like Pi. I like the ending. I think it's sort of, I don't know, that shot where there's a shot towards the end of the movie where Max just sort of can't take it anymore, and he sort of takes a drill to the side of his head.
There's no sort of about it.
Yeah.
He full on does.
Which is super impressive as a shot, and crazy, and super disturbing, along with the shots of the brain with the insects throughout the movie.
Yeah.
Which is super weird. And I don't know. And then, the last scene is sort of him sitting on a park bench. That girl that you mentioned earlier with the calculator, Jenna, starts asking him math questions, and he doesn't know the answer. And we sort of go back to a shot that we've seen a couple times throughout the movie of just sort of this tree just sort of blowing in the wind, essentially. And that's sort of what he's looking at. He doesn't know the answer to math anymore, and he's just sort of smiling, maybe for the first time in the movie.
It seems like the first time I can remember that he actually seems to be pleased with anything.
And, he's just sort of, math is gone, and now he's just enjoying things. He's essentially the movie saying, stop trying to figure it out, just enjoy it. It's going to end anyways.
That seems to be what you're supposed to take from that. I couldn't really get anything else. The whole movie is so obsessed with numbers, and then, he's analyzing everything about life to the point, as you said, that he can't enjoy it anymore. And then, I guess, a drill to the temple takes out the part of your brain that understands math, but leaves you relatively fine, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, there's always the argument to be made that he's also dead.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, you can make a lot of arguments about what really happened in this movie. And again, another thing we're going to see over and over is an unreliable narrator or main character.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything can really happen that happened in this movie. Some of it's clearly hallucinations and things that didn't really happen, and you're not sure what to make of which. Would you say that's true?
Yes. The brain in the subway is unlikely.
Yeah. And, he sees people that aren't really there, and then, it's just an unreliable narrator, which is something that I think can be done pretty well in movies. I thought it was done all right in this one, but it's just... another kind of psychological factor. It's you're so into the mind of this character that you're not just having a kind of an omniscient view of everything, watching everything go down. You're very much stuck to his subjective point of view.
Yeah. And it's also sort of like they don't know if what they're seeing is real. I don't think it's implied that Max fully believes what he's seeing is real all the time.
Yeah. He seems to be kind of aware that he's losing his mind, and all this experimentation that he's doing with, the pills and the beta blockers and these injections to get rid of his headaches and to try to, I guess, feel more sane as a human being, not just to enjoy himself, but to be able to make sense of the world properly. That's something that we see recurring.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, that's all I got to say about Pi.
Yeah, nothing else on Pi?
No. Cool. Well, you wanted to talk about the first film, director's first film.
Yeah, it's because I was just trying to think of, this might be something we get back to later, but a person with a similar career trajectory to Darren Aronofsky. And, it's kind of coming up. I mean, you kind of establish yourself with this really cheap film. I mean, he got all the money for it himself and just kind of made this, shopped around to festivals, and people, you know, really got behind it. And do you think that's something that we're still going to...
You didn't mention the name.
I was just talking about the way that Darren Aronofsky did it, but it is kind of a path that we have seen other people take, as you said, Christopher Nolan with The Following, a very, very cheap movie to just start his career. And then it just shows that, you know, he can tell a story pretty well. He's got his own visual style, absolutely. And that's just one path that certainly those two people aren't the only people to have done it, but you can see kind of a similar trajectory, right?
Yes. Yeah. I think Pi is a more interesting movie than Following is, but
okay,
you know, I mean, certainly similar. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head who also falls into that, but
okay. We don't want to talk about Kevin Smith, right? He doesn't exist.
Oh yeah, no. Oh, Kevin Smith made one movie that was very revolutionary and halfway good. It was called Clerks.
Yeah, he scraped some money together and just made a black and white movie.
Yeah, I think it cost like $16,000 or something, and it was good. It's a pretty decent movie. And what it did for independent film and comedy is pretty impressive. That he doesn't really make good movies is unimpressive. And I guess, I don't know. I know David Lynch had a black and white debut, and
right.
But I've seen like parts of it.
So do you think that we're past that point? Do you think with digital technology and color footage being so cheap that no one's really going to have to start their career that way for budgetary reasons?
Exactly. No, we don't have black and white debuts anymore. We've got shot on a Canon 5D.
And I mean, we see things like The Man Who Wasn't There by the Coen brothers, which was one that was halfway through their career. They did it black and white for stylistic reasons because of the, you know, it's supposed to be kind of like a noir that they only had black and white, or mostly only had black and white back then. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you can certainly do some fun things with it visually and stylistically, but yeah, I think we're past the point of ever seeing that just for financial reasons. And if you're going to see a black and white movie now, it's very likely just going to be because of a choice that they wanted to make, not the one that they needed to make.
Absolutely.
Cool. Want to move on to Requiem for a Dream?
Let's.
I'll just leave a minute blank so we can put the music in.
Yeah. At this point, that seems to be... I mean, you just saw the movie for the first time, right?
I saw part of it in high school, but not full on.
Okay, because I saw all of it in high school all of the times. I've seen this movie like 20 times.
I look at this and I was reading about it, and before I even saw it, very recently, I knew it had a cult following and that a lot of people who liked it really, really liked it and bought it and have the poster, which, you know, was kind of a staple of dorm rooms a couple years before we were in them.
There's a difference between a cult following and a youth cult following, I think.
Okay.
This is primarily youth cult following. This is people that I went to high school with that also really like this movie. If they were to watch it now, would probably accept that it's not as good as they thought, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas a cult following, like, say, one that's building for The Fountain, is something that's more, you know, it's a better movie.
It's not as dependent on you being young when you saw it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mentioned this in something I wrote about Matthew Lillard, that it's sort of like SLC Punk and Spun were sort of in this as well. It's just sort of like any drug movie made from 1998 to like 2002 that was edited like Requiem for a Dream was, is something that the kids loved.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I was no exception. I was a youth, you know, like it's...
I think about cult following is it's supposed to be a movie that you really like. You kind of think that you get something about it that maybe other people don't see, and you watch it a lot. Would you say those are all characteristics of a cult movie?
Sure. I mean, I've never really thought about what a cult...
Yeah.
I think I'm a big fan of a lot of movies that are called, like, cult favorites, but I never know why I'm a member of the cult, you know? Like, if
okay.
If Pi, I guess, has a small cult following, but if Sean Gillette walked up to me with, like, a thing of Pi Kool-Aid and was like, drink it, I wouldn't just drink it immediately, you know? Like,
is that pie-flavored Kool-Aid, or
is it rhubarb? I only drink rhubarb pie-flavored.
Okay, well, I really just, it's not that Requiem was a terrible movie, but it is a cult movie. And I think part of a cult movie, whether it's a comedy or a drama or a horror movie or anything, it's something that people like to watch over and over.
Yep.
And
I can see why I wanted to watch this movie over and over. It's Very interesting visually.
I have no desire to see this movie again.
That's fine.
And not just because it's like, yeah, okay. I know it's not supposed to be a feel-good movie. I know it's not supposed to be like a fun movie. Like, yeah, that was awesome. I want to relive that experience because there's obviously very gross and painful and depressing and nauseating and sad parts about that movie. But I guess there definitely is some good stuff visually. But I don't know if I ever want to see that movie again. And again, not because it made me so uncomfortable, because I've rewatched movies that made me more uncomfortable than that, but there's just no part of me that really wants to sit through that again.
And that's understandable. I'm sure I haven't watched it since probably I was 18, and until this past week, and I'm in no rush to watch it again, but I'm kind of that way with every movie I watched 20 times growing up. But it's a movie about addiction, essentially. But although I did find things in the movie now that I never found before, which I thought was surprising and interesting. But and it's sort of how addiction basically ruins people's lives, be it heroin or uppers, you know. And stylistically, the movie is very, very interesting. The editing is crazy. The cinematography is not bad. It's pretty good at times, and the music is awesome. Score, you will recognize the theme from Requiem for a Dream from about 8,000 other movies, pretty much every football highlight big hit clips you've ever seen.
Even if you've never seen Requiem for a Dream, you've heard that song upwards of 100 times.
Yeah. And it's in Lord of the Rings, Two Towers. There's sort of like a redone version that's in that movie. Yeah.
Well, Darren Aronofsky said that this one isn't... Requiem's not about just addiction. It's not just about drug addiction. I mean, absolutely, it's... Sarah gets hooked on the uppers that she gets as an attempt to lose weight.
Such a bummer. Hers is the most depressing to me.
Yeah, I think it is. I think that's my favorite arc in that movie, but again, I didn't love that movie anyway.
Thanks.
In case you guys,
it's becoming the new obviously in Christopher Nolan, Jim Sagan, like Requiem.
Well, hey, little spoilers. That's gonna be my review for a lot of these movies that talk about today. But yeah, he's kind of just saying that this isn't just a drug movie. Obviously, the three younger characters, that is the issue, and it is for Sarah as well, but Herx comes from a place of, you know, wanting to lose weight, but that's not all that she's really going for, right?
Well, she's... How do you mean?
Well, I mean, she gets that call that she's going to appear on this TV show, and she has this red dress that she wants to be able to fit into for it. But we're not supposed to just think that she just wants to be skinny just so she'll look good on TV, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, she sort of wants to go back to a time when her life wasn't really depressing.
Yeah, absolutely. She's lost her husband by this point. She has one son who has moved out, who only seems to come back to steal her TV to sell it for drugs.
Yeah.
Like, habitually.
Yeah.
It's just very much this red dress, I thought, was a big metaphor for her just wanting to get back to that time, you know.
Yep.
During when her son graduated, which would have been when her husband was alive, when her son probably wasn't as addicted to heroin. It's very much about her wanting to get that back, and her arc is all about, you know, under the guise of trying to get onto this TV show and making sure she looks good for this TV show, but it's really about getting back part of your, you know, a lost part of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that extends to the other characters as well, or are they more simplistically just drug addicts?
I think it's pretty clear, at least in Marlon Wayans' character. I think his name... Tyrone? We get a couple scenes of Tyrone where we sort of see flashbacks to him as a child or thinking of his mother. And I mean, this sort of gets back to the rest of the movie, or the other characters as well, in that at the end of the movie, I think the last shot of pretty much everybody shows them curling up in the fetal position. So it's all sort of about getting back to a place where they were happy or where they were comfortable, you know? And the whole thing about the movie is that it's just there to make you uncomfortable. These characters get progressively more uncomfortable with their lives. And then they just want to go back to the place that was the most comfortable, where you didn't have to think, you didn't have to do anything. You just sort of had to be on your way to existence.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like wanting a do-over type of thing. And I mean, all of the stuff in this movie is very over the top. It's not a subtle movie. Aronofsky in general is not big on subtlety. But, you know, I think that I think it works as far as that part. And I think that the movie gets progressively, I don't know, there's some things like everything's sort of heightened as the movie goes along. Like as the characters are getting more addicted, the movie gets more intense, the editing gets more intense, and the music especially gets more intense. And I like that. I like the movie as sort of a technical thing. I mean, it's not a great movie by any means. I think as a teenager, I don't think I would have tried to convince anybody of that. But it's certainly worth watching if you can handle some fairly disgusting moments.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about kind of the visual style? I mean, it's pretty well known for having, you know, more cuts than a movie of its length by almost twice as much.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of the split screen, the tight close-ups. These are kind of some of the visual things it got known for.
Yeah.
Do you find that all that works? And is that kind of the visual stuff you like about it? Or is there something else?
I just think it is the visual stuff. And it's certainly the visuals that were the reason I liked it when I was younger. And the reason I liked it so much, you know, it was just like, there's so much to see in the frame. So why wouldn't you watch this movie a couple times as somebody, you know, as 16-year-old me, you know? Yeah, I think visually it's interesting. I would probably write it off now. You know, if Requiem for the Dream came out now, I would probably write it off for that style. But that's also a very early 2000s style.
It just
wouldn't exist now. Like if Aronofsky was the same age making Requiem for a Dream now, it would look very different.
Yeah.
And some of the cinematography is really, really good, even without outside of the editing, where like when they're taking the television at the beginning across the boardwalk, there's a couple of really good shots in that. The shot of Jennifer Connelly underwater right before she starts screaming is really nice. I really love the snorkel shot of her after she leaves the apartment of her former psychiatrist.
Right.
And she's just had sex with him for money, essentially. And she's just like trying to get outside. And the second she gets outside in the rain, she just turns over and vomits. And I think that's a really good shot.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. It's just, you know, technical reasons I like this movie specifically. Jared Leto sucks.
thought that was Jake Gyllenhaal. I'm kidding. Not to dwell on it too much again, because we've talked about it and we will mention it a few more times, but we get kind of mostly with Sarah, we get some more kind of unreliable visuals that she's kind of losing her mind a little bit. The fridge is first making noise and then kind of chasing her, and then the TV she's watching so much, the crew of the show seems to come out and they treat her room like a studio, and
one of whom is carrying a pie.
Yeah.
Which I hate. I hate it when people do that.
Really?
Yeah. There's one of the crew members comes in carrying a pie clipboard. And I mean, obviously pie, Aronofsky's previous movie. I hate it when directors do that.
I thought you liked it when Michael Bay throws his Bad Boy 2 posters in.
We are judging a director who is generally taken seriously, aside from a director that only I take seriously.
Okay.
And the reason I like Michael Bay is specifically Michael Bay-y things, whereas Aronofsky, I like his separate films.
Okay.
And it's totally different thing. But not totally different, but it's different. And I just really don't like it when you're sort of in a serious movie and it's sort of... This is an extremely serious movie.
Yeah, it really is.
And it just sort of like self-reflexivity like that doesn't often work.
Yeah. In a really dramatic scenario.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I see what you mean. The title, I mean, Requiem for a Dream, I guess the dream was just, what, was it the thing we already touched on about a simpler time when you were just young?
I would think so, yeah.
Okay. It's... an awesome, overly dramatic title.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like anything involving Requiem in the title is super dramatic.
Even that Seattle Supersonics documentary, Requiem for a Dream.
Well, I groaned at that because it's a playoff of Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah.
You know? Anything with Requiem is a terrible, just over dramatic.
Anything else on Requiem?
Nope. I'm good.
Cool. Want to move on to The Fountain?
Let's do it.
Cool.
Yeah, so The Fountain was Aronofsky's next movie, which ended up coming out 5 years after Requiem for a Dream, I think.
Had some production troubles.
Yeah, yeah. It was initially planned as a $70 million sci-fi movie with bigger scale scenes, like sort of big action scenes. And
bigger stars.
Brad Pitt and Cate Blanchett were attached. And it just sort of fell through when... Brad Pitt left, Aronofsky really didn't like The Matrix, and that's sort of what the Fountain was, sort of his anti-Matrix film, in that he felt that sci-fi in general had become very obsessed with gadgets and technology and stuff like that, and he sort of wanted to take it back to the idea of it being about, you know, being human, or there being some sort of metaphor or allegory in there for humanity. And I suppose he thought The Matrix was completely devoid of humanity or something. And
no Keanu Reeves movie is devoid.
But yeah, and it was a $70 million picture. Brad Pitt ended up leaving. And by the time the movie was made, it starred Hugh Jackman, Rachel Weisz, and had $35 million budget as opposed to the 70 that was initially planned.
And Hugh Jackman wasn't even Hugh Jackman at this point, right?
But yeah, the X-Men and X-Men 2 had happened.
I guess the second one would have been out too.
Yeah. X2 was 2003, I think.
Okay.
And yeah, and it was sort of, I mean, the $35 million budget, that's not $35 million production budget. $18 million of it was spent before they ended up shooting the movie, when it was still like a bigger movie. Aronofsky got to do a shit ton of research.
Go to Guatemala and meet with Mayan civilization and stuff. Yeah.
Basically anything you would get to do on a big budget production financed by a studio, he got to do for this, when it was a big budget production. But so, I mean, my guess is that, because I read $18 million was spent in pre-production, I would assume that $18 million is included in the $35 million budget. It's about Hugh Jackman. Sorry.
I was going to say, do you want to try to synopsize this one? Because it's a tough one.
It's tricky.
It's a bit of a mess. But
I've seen this movie about 10 times, so I should be able to do it.
Kind of three stories at once.
Yes. It's easy to break down in three different stories, 5 centuries apart each. There's a conquistador. Takes place in Spain, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But they both sound British. Do Spanish people sound British?
All old civilizations sound British.
That's the thing. The only reason I'm wondering this is because Aronofsky seems like more of a stickler for authenticity.
No, I thought that too. Prince of Persia is British. It's all
British.
Well,
okay, Prince of Persia, again, not a serious film, but come on. What was I going to say? Yeah, so there's the conquistador, and he is trying to find this sort of mythical tree of life, you know? And then 5 centuries later, the conquistadors.
That's a Brad Pitt movie.
Yeah, very, very different movies, oddly enough. Yeah, and then the conquistador's name is Thomas, I suppose. Yeah, it's Thomas. And 5 centuries later, we've got Tommy again, Hugh Jackman, who is a scientist of some sort, or geneticist, or some specialized science.
A neurologist. They're doing a lot of brain stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. And his wife, Izzy, is dying from cancer. I didn't really say tumor at some, like, brain tumor at some point, but is it cancer or is it brain tumor? Do you remember?
I think it's a tumor, because when they're working on the monkey, the monkey's getting smarter, and all of his other kind of vital signs are going back, and he's being younger and healthier, but the tumor's not going anywhere, which is Tommy's only concern. So my understanding, it's a brain tumor.
Cool. Well, not cool, but, you know.
not that kind
of
cool.
And, yeah, he's sort of trying to basically cure his wife's disease before she dies. Like, he doesn't want his wife to die. I mean, who would? And, yeah, it's sort of his quest to do that. And then our last character, Tom, or at least our last version of Hugh Jackman, named Tom, he's sort of this, it's in the future, and he's just sort of sitting in his weird spaceship that's just this circle with a tree in it, and he does a lot of yoga, he does a lot of Tai Chi, and he's sort of like this very relaxed, futuristic man.
With a shaved head, and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he seems to be basically like the last man, you know, or some type of thing like that. The tree is all he has in his life, and it's sort of like a representation of a lost love is what the tree is. And yeah, these three stories come together somehow, and it's yeah, you're right, it's super tricky to describe. I feel like I did the best I could.
Yeah, well, no, you certainly got the three threads of the story down. They are constantly intersecting and, you know, replaying clips from one story. They're seamlessly going into one another. You're not really sure for a lot of it, you know, what has just happened or if that was a... It's not even as though it's a flashback. I guess it kind of is. But yeah, he's playing a character, as you said, 500 years apart every time. And it is supposed to be essentially him, in different levels of metaphor of him trying to achieve this goal of vaguely defeating death.
Yeah. Yeah.
But all in very different ways. Finding a tree of life in the 1500s, finding a cure for tumors in 2000s. And what would you say is going on in 2500?
He's just trying to get his love back or something. I don't know. It's just sort of,
yeah,
he doesn't want to let, I don't know, it die totally. Like it's, the tree is still alive, you know?
Yeah. And it's certainly open to interpretation. I mean, there's a lot that you could read into it. Did you hear the thing about the director's commentary?
Yeah, I listened to it, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was the story with that?
Warner Brothers, the movie did not make money, and totally divided critics. Like, it opened at the Venice Film Festival. The critic screening, it was booed by some critics. The first public screening, it got a 10-minute standing ovation.
Yeah.
You know, so this is a movie that does divide people, and divided me. Like, the first time I saw it and the second time I saw it, I had completely different reactions to the exact same movie. And... which is so weird to me. I still don't even know why I decided to watch it a second time, because I really didn't like it the first time. I love this movie. And Warner Brothers, the movie did not make money. It made about $10 million at the box office. And since it didn't catch on with every critic, like some of Aronofsky's later movies would, it didn't sort of have that promotional push via critics and via award season. So Warner Brothers said the movie didn't make enough money to justify having a commentary track, which seems ridiculous to me because I don't know how much it costs to record a commentary track. I can say, as the owner of a $100 USB microphone who records podcasts, it doesn't cost a lot.
No, and Aronofsky was obviously, we'll get to, more than willing to do it.
Yeah, yeah. And he wanted to, you know, and... Yeah. They recorded it in his living room, and it's actually kind of funny because, like, he lives in New York City, he says in the commentary, and you can, like, sort of hear cars occasionally in the background, yeah, like, honking and stuff.
So he just recorded it and then released it online for people to listen to.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. What do you think caused that difference between the critical review at the festival and the public review? One thing is... that I'm just going to throw out there. Do you think it's one of those movies that the director kind of makes it intentionally confusing and weird, and maybe sometimes the public doesn't know what they've just seen, so they have to pretend it was brilliant so they don't look like idiots?
I do think that is part of it. To be honest, had you told me that those two things, like, there were two separate screenings at this film festival of The Fountain, one of them some people booed and the other received a 10-minute standing ovation, I would have assumed that the critics were the standing ovation.
Yeah.
I think that's probably part of it. I think if you're willing to get swept up in the movie as well, I think it can be a very emotional movie. And I think maybe that's part of it. I mean, and then sort of like all you need is maybe like 25 people out of 100 to have really liked this movie and stand up, and then just sort of it'll spiral.
Yeah, you know? Everyone.
10-minute standing ovation. I just get so bored.
Oh my God. I couldn't. There's nothing I would ever give a 10-minute
like,
standing ovation.
Even
to.
If I was Darren Aronofsky watching a 10-minute standing ovation for one of my movies, like, what do you do? Do you walk up in the front with your arms raised? Like, yes, I made this film. And then you just start spinning as people throw flowers at you.
For 10 whole minutes, though. Like,
you'd get dizzy, even if you're just doing slight spins.
I think if I did something and people really loved it after about 4 minutes of applaud, I'd be like, okay, that's great. Thank you very much. I'm going to go now. Well,
who knows if he was there or anything like that?
Yeah, it's not true.
But I think there's probably a general rule. If you're getting a standing ovation, you just sort of let it happen.
Yeah.
It's particularly for something that was 6 years in the making or whatever this was.
Yeah. It sounded like a pretty frustrating experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. As you said, they, a lot of the money got away from them for initially the budget cuts, and then some of the money that they had spent already when they had a larger budget and didn't need to worry about spending every dollar in a certain way. So as you said, they did some kind of research stuff. Do you want to talk a little bit about the ways they compensated for that and how they got around some of the CGI stuff? I mean, three different time periods, you're going to run into, you know, sets. I mean, there's battle scenes in the 1500s. There's, you know, big elaborate temples and castles, and then in modern times there's nothing too crazy, but I mean it's still a very state-of-the-art, you know, neurological facility, whatever you call those. And then obviously 2500, you're in deep space, you've got spaceships, you've got, you know, a whole outer space scene. Do you just want to talk a bit about how they kind of got around doing that on a much smaller budget?
Well, they shot everything at a soundstage, like the movie, with the exception of the scenes at, I forget what her character's name is, but Ellen Burstyn's farm. And
that was Ellen Burstyn.
Yeah.
Okay. From Requiem.
Yeah.
Okay.
Except for that scene. And there's something else that I just can't remember, but it was all sort of shot in this one Montreal soundstage. And I mean, it's fairly obvious because it's a very tightly constructed movie. There's a lot of tight hallways. And I mean, even the action sequence is very small.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of, Aronofsky said that he essentially scaled back. He cut out a lot of big expensive set pieces and realized that the action wasn't what was important about the movie, and that you could really tone that down to be the very small action sequences we get. The biggest one coming in like the first minute of the movie, essentially.
Yeah. And that helps him get back to that whole thing about, as we talked about The Matrix before, it's, he didn't want this to be a spectacle. He didn't want that to be the centerpiece of this movie. He really wanted it to be grounded in the relationships.
Yeah. And that being said, this movie is gorgeous. The particularly like some of the cinematography and the futuristic scenes where there's one scene where Hugh Jackman's doing like Tai Chi in silhouette, and all you see are these stars in the background. It's just really gorgeous. But anyway, there's a lot of macro photography was used, which is sort of like, they sent a guy to do all this photography and sort of use that as effects for like the stars and stuff like that. So as opposed to, you know, using CGI, and there were some matte paintings, I'm sure, particularly in the future scenes. But to be honest, I don't totally understand how all of it was done. I've read as much as I can, but I...
Oh, okay. But did you read anything kind of about using slides from microscopes and close-ups of organisms?
I didn't
stuff
completely
like that?
Understand that.
Oh, okay. I might be wrong about this, but my understanding of it is a lot of the deep space stuff where you've got those yellow...
Oh, that's what the yellow backgrounds were.
Yeah, gotcha. That's what I thought. And it's kind of interesting because it does tie in with some of the spirals and patterns that we get discussed more thoroughly in Pi.
Yeah. Well, I think there are a lot of links between this movie and Pi.
Yeah.
But I'll get to those.
Okay. But yeah, basically they just took, kind of they do a close-up of an organism, like a very, very extreme close-up to the point where you're not even sure what you're looking at. It's just, you know, two or three colors and very kind of vague, ambient, amorphous shapes. And then they would use that as the background. So, and I think it works really well with a lot of things that we've been talking about, because it doesn't look dated, because it's something from nature. I find that it looks really good because, again, just going back to kind of those patterns and those things that exist in nature, you see them everywhere. Even if you've never looked at a close-up of this organism, you've seen this vague pattern and this thing, that the way that nature forms itself, you've seen it in a smaller or a larger scale. And so what he's doing is just zooming right up on one of them, and I think it works really well. Obviously, give it 30 years and it might look a little dated. It's tough to say a movie doesn't look dated, you know, 6 years after the fact. But I think it looks really good.
Yeah, and I think the chances of this movie aging well visually are pretty high. And, I mean, there are going to be some things. I mean, there are things towards the end particularly that, I mean, will be tough for them to age well, just because it sort of looked awkward at the time. It looks awkward now.
Yeah.
But I think in general, this movie will age better than probably the $70 million version would. Because how good was CGI in 2004 or 2005 when this movie would have come out? You know, like Brad Pitt left the fountain to make Troy. Troy is a movie that probably looks like shit now.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was a terrible movie to begin with, but now it probably doesn't even look nice.
Yeah, and it's kind of just one of those situations where it seems like being restrained by having to make the most with a little bit of money stopped you from being ambitious and hubristic. And now you've kind of got a less ambitious, but something that ended up working, I think, in the favor of the film.
Yeah, less ambition, but more focus.
Yeah.
And I think we'll sort of get that You get that in every one of Aronofsky's movies, because he's always got very small budgets. This might be the biggest production budget he had, and it was like $17 million after the $18 million that had been used already.
And kind of something we talked about as we were talking about people's black and white debut, but when you have such limited money, you really have to plan out every shot. You can't just show up and say, okay, let's do this. If that doesn't work, we'll do this, and we'll give it a stab at this. Like, when you have limited funds and limited time and limited resources, you have to plan things out a lot better, and it's, you know, obviously that's going to end up with a better result.
Yeah. And just to touch on the themes of the movie, like I said, it's very similar to Pi, particularly as far as Tommy's storyline goes, being the modern Hugh Jackman, is that he can't accept that his wife is going to die. And he's just working tirelessly to try and make sure that doesn't happen, even though, I mean, it's essentially impossible. And it even seems like towards the end, Izzy has come to terms with the fact that she's going to die. And this goes with something that Aronofsky said about the research he was doing, is that a lot of people who die young, like at Izzy's age, you know, mid-30s or so, they sort of die alone because their family can't accept what's happening, even though the actual person is dying, has sort of come to terms with it. After she has a seizure in a museum, that was the other thing they didn't shoot.
Yeah, right.
After she has the seizure at the museum, she says to Tommy, I was okay with it, or something like that. And but Tommy's still not. And Tommy goes from there to the lab, and it's sort of, and when she dies, he just can't handle it. He's like, he's just angry, you know? And the point of that is, like Pi, it's sort of, it doesn't help you at all to be obsessed with this thing you can't solve, or this thing you can't fix. He calls death a disease, or Tommy calls death a disease while he's at the peak of his anger about Izzy. And it's not a disease. It's a natural thing. It's a thing that happens. It's a thing that will happen. And to sort of try and beat that, or to beat nature, like Max tries to do in Pi, is impossible. And you will miss everything that's good about actually being alive, such as, you know, Tommy not spending as much time with Izzy as he could have if he wasn't working. I'm sure they would have been forgiving, you know, given that he doesn't have a lot of time with her. And I really enjoyed that about the movie. You know, what do you think about it as far as that?
I think you're absolutely right. It's in the way that Max overanalyzing his life and everything about it prevented him from enjoying it. Tommy trying to prolong her life, he really just squanders their last bit of time together. And as you said, there's a point where she comes to terms with it. And even though he's right there, emotionally, they're in entirely different places because she's accepted it. She knows it's the end of her life. She can feel it coming. And she wants to be with Tommy, and not necessarily in a very literal sense, but like emotionally and spiritually, to occupy kind of the same headspace at the end of their lives would be a good way for them to, you know, see each other for the last time. And then this obviously gets carried out into the, you know, 500 years later when we're just in deep space. Again, we probably didn't mention that much about it, but in the 1500 stuff, Thomas, okay. It's a very spiritual, religious thing. It's they're trying to find this ancient temple that the Mayans had hid, and, you know, there's a map to it and all this stuff, and it was supposed to be, as you said, where the Tree of Life is, and that's what he's working towards. It's very much in a lot. The first segment and the third segment, not so much the modern one, is very much about spirituality. It's certainly present in the second one as well, but the first and third one, it's a lot of religion and spirituality. And in part of the research, when they went to Guatemala and some other places to, you know, do some research on Mayan history and Mayan religions and things like that, that was kind of one of their tenets, and it's one you see in Eastern religion a lot. It's just about accepting death, and really the only way to beat death is to agree to its inevitability, which is, it sounds kind of contradictory, but, you know, in an abstract spiritual sense, it is the only way that you're going to be able to transcend that. And that's what so much of the third segment is, the part of in the future in 2500. his kind of dealing with this tree, it's he is, the goal is to kind of give up on life in order to really fully appreciate it, and the way to kind of defeat death is to fully accept its power. So there's a lot of a spiritual stuff there, and I think people of different religions and, you know, different worldviews would take a lot from those parts of the movies and be able to have their own opinions on it. But Aronofsky does talk about that in the director's commentary and some stuff that I've read about it, and he does draw a lot from those religions. And so it really is kind of a very spiritual and abstract movie with a lot of its themes, but it is in the middle setting, the contemporary one, it's tied very much to science, but in the first and third one, it's just mostly about spirituality.
Yeah, and there's another thing that I find extremely interesting about the movie is that Izzy is writing a novel. As in her last days, she's writing a novel that is called The Fountain. And she's writing basically the story of the conquistador. And she's doing all this research, so it's, you know, supposed to be sort of tied to life, you know, to what would have happened in real life or what the Mayans would have believed and stuff like that. But what we are seeing as the conquistador setting is we're implied that we are watching a story. We're not watching something that was supposed to actually have happened. We're supposed to watch a narrative that was written by Izzy using extensive research by the sounds of things. And the key line of the movie, I think, is when Izzy says to Tommy, she's not going to finish the novel. She's going to give it to him with this, you know, this pen, and you can finish it. I can't write the last chapter. You finish it. And then she says, together we can live forever. And it's sort of saying we can live together forever through this piece of art. We can sort of create this one thing together, and it will be a way for our love to exist in this world, you know, continuing on. And I think that's super interesting, made significantly more interesting by the fact that Darren Aronofsky and Rachel Weisz were married at the time of the movie. And I suppose my question to you is, does that make the movie more interesting to you?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's going to stick around. I mean, there's going to be that part of their relationship that's always alive in a vague sense, because this was a collaborative effort between the two, and they're obviously very, you know, romantically linked at the time. I'd say it does certainly add another dimension to things. And
does it make the movie better or worse now that they're no longer together?
Oh, I think it makes it better. I mean, it's this whole idea of the finite nature of our time on Earth, and, you know, you can scale that back to just the finite nature of our relationship. You know, people break up, even if you stay married forever and you die at the end. I mean, at that point you're separate, but these finite relationships that we have in our lives, as we're romantically linked to something or to somebody, and then that time produces certain memories. And then in the case of filmmakers and actresses, it results in certain works of art. And in a way, yeah, I mean, they're always going to be together because there is this picture that they made together. And yeah, I mean, they've broken up, but there's always kind of this little, you know, nugget that was created when they were an item.
Yeah, and The Fountain is kind of the movie that continually reminds me that I do think Darren Aronofsky's probably a decent person, as opposed to, you know, the guy I think comes off kind of like a douchebag in a lot of interviews and stuff like that, is that Rachel Weisz and Darren Aronofsky were together for the extent of the production of The Fountain, and like the pre-production and the writing and all that stuff. The idea existed before they were together, probably, but that the movie was essentially written while they were together, I think makes it, you know, makes Aronofsky come off as a little more human than I think he does in his other movies.
Yeah.
And it's one thing I really enjoy about The Fountain, and why I think it's his best movie by far. And yeah, I really like that aspect of The Fountain, and just the idea of, I mean, we've talked about it in the Spielberg podcast as well, as far as the art being the only way you can really beat death. Yeah. Is making something that will last. So together they can maybe live forever if the cult following that The Fountain has adopted keeps living on past them, you know?
Yeah.
which I think is unlikely, but who knows?
Yeah, but I think this is probably my favorite one of his too. I mean, go see this movie if you haven't seen it, which you most likely haven't. Mm. But it's definitely worth a watch. I mean, it engages you. You do feel like you have to keep up with it because, especially with the three storylines, having heard this, I mean, probably makes it a little bit easier. But you still have to keep up. When I was said earlier about, you know, the first segment, the second segment, the third segment, it's not that simple. Like, it's really not linear like that. They don't do Tom's conquistador story and then his neurology story and then his space yoga instructor story. They're intertwining. I mean, lines from one period 500 years ago applies to this scene, and they go back and forth, and you see some things repeated and cuts back and forth. So, yeah, it's, you know, you do have to keep up with it, but it's an interesting movie, and I don't think I'll go rush and watch it again, but I was happy that I watched it one time for sure.
Cool. So yeah, that is the end of part one of the Aronofsky podcast. Next week, we will be back discussing movies that are called The Wrestler and Black Swan, and just sort of a continued look at Aronofsky as a auteur, I suppose.
Yes.
So yeah, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. This episode has been brought to you by Auto-Tune. Hey, hey. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.